This is the first. I commit to taking it. Sign it by writing down the action and the date. Now, take a break. Walk around. Breathe. Breathing is good. A final note. The phrases, don't take this personally, and don't take yourself so seriously, are misguided suggestions. Do take it personally. Do take yourself seriously. This is your life. It hopefully has its hilarious moments. However, this is serious business. Or what's the point? If you don't take it seriously, there won't be enough of you here. The results you're experiencing and the emotions roiling within you are direct results of how you are showing up to yourself and others all day, every day. What about making it personal at home but keeping a politically strategic distance at work? If that is the model, we ultimately absent our spirit from our work. Then we come home and complain about it all, saying, my boss is an idiot, our customers are unreasonable, my colleagues aren't pulling their weight. Whoever awaits our arrival at home receives the brunt of all our angst and anger. There is no workable separation of selves at work and at home. We are ourselves all over the place. And it is this real self that is felt and experienced at a deeply personal level by ourselves and everyone on the receiving end of us, whether we acknowledge it or not. Ultimately, you need to take yourself seriously. Take your life personally. Otherwise, there won't be enough of you here.
Principle 3. Be here, prepared to be nowhere else.
There is a profound difference between having a title, a job description, or a marriage license, and being someone to whom people commit at the deepest level. If we wish to accomplish great things in our organizations and in our lives, then we must come to terms with a basic human need. We must recognize that humans share a universal longing to be known, and being known, to be loved. When our conversations with others disregard this core need, our lives can seem like an ongoing, exhausting struggle to influence others to do what we want them to do or to rise to their potential. We persuade, cajole, manipulate, and issue directives. Nothing changes. Deadlines are missed. The scenery is boring. People and relationships are on automatic pilot. Consider this passage in the Fifth Discipline Field Book, edited by Peter Senge. He writes, among the tribes of northern Natal in South Africa, the most common greeting, equivalent to hello in English, is the expression sawubona. It literally means, I see you. If you are a member of the tribe, you might reply by saying sikhona, or I am here. The order of the exchange is important. Until you see me, I do not exist. It's as if when you see me, you bring me into existence. Only when we genuinely see the people who are important to us can we hope to succeed as agents for positive change. Having misread many individuals throughout our lifetime, however, we often find that discovering someone else's authentic self can be complicated by our increasing cynicism. In Philip Roth's The Human Stain, a character suggests, by a certain age, one's mistrust is so exquisitely refined that one is unwilling to believe anybody, or to know anyone, or to get too close. Yet we must learn to rebuild the links that connect people and that provide an effective antidote to cynicism and disaffection. We must transform the way we speak, the way we ask, the way we listen. How do we get to know another person? How do we get past how are you, I'm fine? By really asking and really listening, by being with someone, even if only for a brief moment, prepared to be nowhere else. Here's a personal anecdote about really asking and really listening. When I was 16, I got a summer job as an assistant to Fred Timberlake, head of sales and marketing at a paint store in Missouri. I could type 100 words a minute, and as this was long before computers in every cubicle, I sat at an IBM Selectric, the metal ball of type twirling furiously. During my second week on the job, the Selectric suddenly froze, and I looked up, shocked to see Mr. Timberlake holding the cord after having pulled the plug from the outlet. He was smiling. He handed me a sheet of paper. "What do you think of this advertising layout, Susan?" I glanced at the layout and looked behind me, certain that there must be another Susan on the payroll, one who could provide intelligent input. But there was no one there, and Mr. Timberlake was still standing in front of me, waiting for a response. The expression on his face, his posture, and the full-stop silence encompassing my desk and seemingly everything within miles persuaded me that he was really asking. I studied the advertising layout. It featured a stack of paint cans with colorful graphics. My impulse was to shrug and say, "I don't know. I don't have any experience in advertising." However, I had the impression that Mr. Timberlake anticipated my response with a genuine interest. I didn't want to disappoint my boss, so I thought hard. I said, "Well, my mom thought about painting our living room for a long time, but she couldn't make up her mind what color to use, and then she saw a photograph in a magazine of a really pretty room with walls painted a color she liked, and she went right out that day and bought paint. I think the picture helped her imagine what our living room could look like. Maybe if you showed a pretty room with walls painted a great color, it would give people the courage to go buy some paint." Mr. Timberlake listened as I spoke. When I stopped, he stood quietly for a moment, then said, "Remarkable. Thank you, Susan. I'm sending this back to the drawing board." Throughout that summer, whenever my Selectric froze, I would smile and prepare to answer another of Mr. Timberlake's questions. In his presence, I became a bigger human being. Every person who worked for Fred Timberlake would have followed him anywhere. It's amazing how this seemingly small thing, simply paying fierce attention to another, really asking, really listening even during a brief conversation, can evoke such a wholehearted response. When someone really asks, we really tell them, and somehow both of us are validated. Think for a moment about the kind of attention you bring to your conversations. While someone is talking, where are your thoughts? When you are face to face, do you look at the individual in front of you, or do your eyes roam the room in a sort of perpetual surveillance? While you're talking with someone on the telephone, do you scan your email? And can you tell when someone else is scanning his? You'll learn now to be with someone prepared to be nowhere else. You've already done important work. You've conducted an integrity scan, written your stump speech, enlisted others with whom you need to have important conversations. You've had a fierce conversation with yourself using the mineral rights model. The first question you answered in your stump speech was, "Where am I going?" You can't answer the second question, "Who is going with me?" until you know who that someone is. The goal now is for you to be ready to have a fierce conversation with someone else, a conversation that will be significantly differentiated from others you've had. You'll explore an important issue by asking questions and listening carefully to your partner's response. Anyone with whom you have this conversation will go away from it having enjoyed your complete attention and feeling known by you, a rare and wonderful thing. One of the most difficult decisions I've ever made was to stop chairing my group of Seattle CEOs in order to free up some time for writing and speaking. For 13 years, I had a 50-yard line seat on some of the most interesting lives in town. Each month, 16 non-competing CEOs spent a day together, focused on the most pressing issues of three or four of the members. I loved those days and looked forward to the interaction of the group. But the other interaction each month, the one-to-one, was in some ways more satisfying to me. I've talked about these conversations already. This was a member's time alone with me, and mine with him or her. I knew, because my clients had told me in ways I could not discount, that these fierce conversations meant as much to them as they did to me. Reality was interrogated, learning was provoked, the tough issues were tackled, and our relationship was enhanced. Here's the thing I most want you to understand. I had little or no experience in such diverse businesses as rapid prototyping, software development, fine art supplies, public accounting, telecommunications, and commercial construction. What I did have was fierce affection for each of my clients, genuine curiosity about the topic of the moment, and an insatiable appetite for learning, and a fierce resolve to be with each individual prepared to be nowhere else. This set of characteristics translates to personal relationships as well. For those relationships to move forward and upward, you must have fierce affection for the other person. You must have genuine curiosity about what is going on with that person at any given time. You must have an insatiable appetite for learning more every day about who he or she is, and this is helped significantly by your willingness to occasionally set aside all of the topics ping-ponging inside your own head and simply be with this other person here and now. Perhaps you have a creeping foreboding that in some instances all this getting to know someone, all this being present stuff, involves listening endlessly to someone telling you more than you ever wanted to know about a series of boring topics, all the gory details about who did what to whom. This would not work for me or for most people I know. Few of us are blessed with unending patience or the ability to demonstrate genuine interest in every individual or issue that crosses our paths. Time that busy people have set aside to talk with anybody about anything is time not to be taken lightly. Something needs to be set in motion as a result of their time with others. Every conversation has to count. If this sounds like you, or like you in certain situations, then take comfort in knowing that, yes, the conversation is the relationship. One conversation at a time, you are building, destroying, or flatlining your relationships. It is possible, however, to create high intimacy, low maintenance relationships, one relatively brief conversation at a time. If that sounds good to you, keep listening. Somewhere in our histories, most of us have come across an individual who remains a cipher to us, a coworker who seems to be wrapped in Teflon, carrying a shield, a relative with whom you always end up in some kind of misunderstanding. No matter how much you try, you don't seem to be able to connect with that person in any meaningful way. You're not sure where he or she is coming from, and the feeling is probably mutual. You've been tempted to say, I've been hanging out with you for years and I still don't know who you are or what you want. The problem does not always lie in a lack of time together. Almost every busy parent has felt guilty about not spending enough time with his or her child. Most couples express concerns that they have not been spending as much time with their mates as they feel they should. Most leaders suspect that things would go more smoothly if they spent more time with the individuals on their leadership team, and that they, in turn, should do the same with the people who report to them. So we carve out the time, sometimes grudgingly. A parent sits down to talk with a child. A couple gets a babysitter and goes out to dinner. A leader schedules a meeting with a direct report. What happens? Not much. Just space. Uncomfortable space stretching out in front of you. Many do not make it past, "How are you?" "I'm fine." Many of us have imagined saying, I have 3 days to live, or I robbed a bank and I'm running away with a bartender at Trudy's Tavern just to see if anyone would notice. Kathleen DeBurka, the central character in My Dream of You by Nuala O'Phalen, describes a missed conversation with a companion who escorts her to an award ceremony, telling her not to be nervous. Kathleen replies, I'm not nervous in public. She then shares her interior dialogue with the reader. This was an invitation to ask me what I meant. and for me to tell him about being afraid of the people I knew, not the people I didn't know, and for him to tell me what he felt and so on, but he didn't know how to talk that kind of talk. When people are not paying attention, not really engaged, there are many missed opportunities to clamber out of the usual conversational box and talk about something interesting and memorable. However, while most people think the problem lies with others, what if there is something else at work here? What if you're the problem? What if you're so unengaged or unengaging that nobody hears you, nobody really listens to you, nobody really responds to you? Perhaps you're too polite, or too self-conscious, or too self-absorbed, or too politically correct or too cautious. The net result? Unconsciously, we end our conversations as soon as we initiate them, too afraid of what we might say or hear. In the workplace, this translates into this typical exchange. How's the project going? Great. Everything working out? You bet. Good. That's what I like to hear. No one's really asking. No one's really listening. No one engages. Nothing changes. So what do we do about this? For starters, being with someone prepared to be nowhere else takes courage. It's unlikely any of us will really ask unless and until we are prepared to really hear the response and respond in turn. This will mean addressing a potentially difficult or complex topic authentically with someone here and now. Where do we get the courage? In part, simply by recognizing that if you chicken out now, you'll pay the price later. Recognizing that if you or someone else feels a conversation is needed, it is. If a sensitive or significant topic comes up unbidden, seize the moment. Avoiding or postponing a conversation, downplaying its importance, or trying to bluff your way through it only delays and often accelerates a very bad day. A reminder here. So often, people forget that one of the fiercest conversations any of us can have is to tell someone how important he or she is in our lives, how much we value and love that person. For many people, that is more difficult than bringing up a concern. If none of the conversations you listed earlier involves letting someone know what he or she means to you or to your organization, go back and add a conversation. Now let's focus on one of the basics of being present. Eye contact. So simple and yet so difficult. If you're not looking at people when you're talking to them, be aware that they may feel invisible to you, devalued. On the other hand, I do not recommend maintaining maniacal eye contact during your conversations. Many of us have wanted to back away from an avid individual whose eyes seem to drill through us and out the other side. What I do recommend are soft eyes. Years ago, I lived near Tokyo and studied karate. During the last half hour of each session, everyone formed a circle around one individual and could attack the person in the center of the circle from any direction at any time with no warning. When I was the vulnerable individual in the center, I initially strained to see everyone, my eyes darting from person to person, whirling and turning so that I wouldn't miss anything. I often ended up felled, not by someone behind me, but by someone right in front of me. It seemed that the harder I tried to see, the more I missed. The sensei taught us that if, instead of trying to focus on any one thing, we softened our eyes and allowed the world to come to us, we would see a great deal more. We would catch subtle motion. Our peripheral vision would become acute. This was true. Over time, we developed the proverbial eyes in the backs of our heads, and it was effortless. The same thing happens with our listening. We may succeed in hearing every word, yet miss the message altogether. In conversations, soft eyes and soft ears allow a partner to come to you, to communicate to you. It is not about being clever or having degrees in a particular field. It's about being genuinely interested, really asking, and paying fierce attention to the response, to the whole person responding. Recently, I worked with a woman who had incredible hands. I could listen to her through isolated hand movements. At first, I felt self-conscious focusing on her hands, but they had so much to say. At one point, I told her that her hands were wonderfully expressive. She looked at her hands a moment and said, "This morning I put on my coat, and my mother's hand came out the sleeve." There is so much more to listen to than words. Listen to the whole person. For many people, the answer to the question, "What's the opposite of talking?" is waiting to talk. Many think that not speaking when someone is talking is the same as listening. Hearing people's words is only the beginning. Do you also hear their fears, their intentions, their aspirations? In the words of the 13th century Sufi poet Rumi, "Reach your long hand out to another door, beyond where you go on the street where everyone says, 'How are you?' and no one says, 'How aren't you?'" At a recent workshop in Florida, I asked a participant, David, to come to the front of the room and talk about a problem he'd like to solve. I asked a third of the participants to listen for content, a third for emotion, and a third for intent. David spoke about his ongoing struggle with his weight. He discussed his concerns about how his health might suffer if he didn't get on top of this issue, how he didn't feel good in his clothes, how important it was for him to start eating better and exercising, how long he had been struggling with this issue. After a few minutes, I stopped David and asked each group to tell him what they had heard. The content group fed his words back to him almost verbatim. David nodded. The emotion group picked up on his frustration, embarrassment, and helplessness. David acknowledged all of this. The group listening for intent delivered the blow. They said, "You aren't going to do anything about this. Right now it's all just words." David blanched and disagreed with their assessment. On the very next break, he helped himself to brownies. David had given us the usual rhetoric that most of us hear and even say ourselves when trying to lose weight. "I've got to get a handle on this. I'm going to watch what I eat and start exercising." When we listen beyond words for intent, for the scaffolding on which a story hangs, clarity and character emerge. We need to listen this way to ourselves, not just to others. Now you're ready to have a wonderfully fierce conversation with someone at work and someone at home. A powerful aid to being here, prepared to be nowhere else, is your old friend Mineral Rights. Each Mineral Rights conversation will be productive and memorable. Each will develop leadership capabilities of your team members, maturity in your children, closeness with your lover. Each will accomplish the four goals of any and all fierce conversations. First, reality will be interrogated. You'll stay current regarding ground truth. You won't be blindsided by surprises down the road. Using Mineral Rights will help both of you get to the heart of the issue. Second, learning will be provoked. You and your partner are likely to learn much more during a Mineral Rights conversation than you've learned in other meetings. Third, people will be mobilized to tackle the tough challenges. People solve the problems and seize the opportunities that they themselves have named. They will leave this conversation with a sense of accountability for their understanding of the conversation and for their ownership of the outcomes. And fourth, the relationship will be enriched. One of the greatest gifts you can give another is the purity of your attention, not your advice. Mineral rights will require that you hold your ideas about what needs to be done until your partner has had an opportunity to formulate his or her own solutions. You might wonder, why is it essential during mineral rights to ask about someone's emotions? If you don't ask what someone is feeling, it's as if you leave that person sitting in an exquisite car with no gasoline in the tank, which means this car is in no danger of going anywhere. Emotions serve as the gasoline that propels us into action. I have listened to executives, friends, and relatives describe in detail the current ghastly results and future implications if an issue doesn't get resolved, and clearly have no intention of doing anything about it in this lifetime. Not until they explore emotions do they get in touch with the price they are paying. Then and only then does the lit match have something to ignite. Here's your assignment. Schedule a one-to-one with someone at work and someone at home. Choose a person who you sense is struggling with an issue. Speak and think of it as a conversation rather than a meeting. Use mineral rights as your model. Before you begin, ask yourself, what do I need to do to be fully present? What are all the things I'm thinking about that could interfere with my being here prepared to be nowhere else? You'll begin by asking, what is the most important thing you and I should talk about today? Give your colleague or partner some time to check in and consider what you've asked. Don't help the person out. Don't get itchy during the silence and try to help by saying, for example, you said you weren't sure if John is going to work out. Maybe we should talk about that. Or, last weekend we didn't have much time together and you seemed upset. Do you want to talk about that? Let them decide. And if anyone ever responds with, I don't know, your reply should be, what would it be if you did know? This question was inspired by the Zen koan, when you can do nothing, what can you do? Ask the question and wait. Let's revisit a simplified version of the 7-step mineral rights model. Step 1. What is the most important thing you and I should be talking about? Step 2. Describe the issue. What's going on relative to this issue? Step 3. How is this currently impacting you? Who and what else is being impacted? The emphasis is on the word current, so keep your partner focused on current impact and results. Ask what else at least 3 times. Probe feelings. When you consider these impacts, what do you feel? Step 4. If nothing changes, what are the implications? Say, imagine it's a year later and nothing has changed. What is likely to happen? Ask what else? Probe feelings. Step 5. How have you helped create this issue or situation? If someone says, I don't know, then ask, what would it be if you did know? Don't comment on the response other than to say, that's useful to recognize. Then move on. Step 6. What's the ideal outcome? When this is resolved, what difference will that make? When you contemplate these possibilities, what do you feel? And finally, step 7. What's the most potent step you can take to begin to resolve this issue? What exactly are you committed to do and when? When should I follow up with you? As you practice mineral rights and principle 3, being here prepared to be nowhere else, it is helpful to debrief yourself after each conversation. Ask yourself, was I genuinely curious about this person and his or her reality? Did I work to understand what color the corporate or relationship beach ball is from where he or she stands? Did feelings get expressed as well as issues and solutions? What parts of me failed to show up? Who did the most talking? Me is the wrong answer. Over the last 15 years that I've taught and worked with mineral rights, I've seen amazing results and conversations that have unfailingly delved into rich territory. I give myself a secret rule during all mineral rights conversations. I give myself this secret rule in order to accomplish the goals of the conversation, which are to interrogate reality, provoke learning, tackle tough issues, and enrich relationships. My secret rule is questions only. Until the person I am with has answered the question in step 7, what do you see as the next most potent step you need to take? I do not allow myself to make a declarative statement. No cheating, no leading questions such as, have you considered trying? You will be mightily tested. Most people don't do well here. What most of us do when someone says, I have this issue or I have this problem is jump in with, I have this solution or I have this point of view about your issue. Many of us are eager to show what we know, to demonstrate our value to our coworkers, clients, and family members. So as soon as someone says, this is my issue, we leap in with suggestions, stories about our experience, quotes from the latest journals, and we don't notice that our companion's eyes have glazed over. A common experience you no doubt have had is the conversation that begins with your telling someone about something you are grappling with, and before you've even finished the story, the other person says, I know exactly what you mean. About 3 years ago, and he's off and running. In a matter of seconds, this conversation shifted from being about you to being about him. When that occurs, what happens to your interest level? How do you feel about the person who is now regaling you with his story? Not good, right? And let's face it, you've done this yourself. Almost everyone has. If you want to have conversations that further individuals and organizations, then don't do what I just described. Don't take the conversation away from the other person and fill the air with your stories. If my voice seems to have taken on a bit of an edge here, you're not imagining it. This practice of taking the conversation away from other people and making it about ourselves goes on all day, every day, and is a huge relationship killer and a waste of time. Nothing useful happens here. Even if your story is riveting, don't tell it until your companion has answered question 7. By which time you may conclude that the story you wanted to tell is not relevant. The point here is to draw others out with good questions and incredible listening on your part. If you can't do this, you may fail to build deep relationships. So leave your expert storyteller fix-it hat at the door. Come into the conversation with empty hands. Bring nothing but yourself. It is likely that your boss, valued customer, prospective customer, husband, wife, teenage daughter, or next-door neighbor will come away from this conversation feeling furthered in his or her life somehow. That person will sense that his or her world of meaning has been expanded and most decidedly will look forward to another conversation with you. Not bad for a single conversation. A fierce conversation is not about holding forth on your point of view, but about provoking learning by sitting with someone side by side and jointly interrogating reality. The goal is to expand the conversation rather than narrow it. Questions are much more effective in provoking learning than answers. And even when you're not using mineral rights, at least once a day, let a conversation truly be about someone else. I'd like to conclude this third principle with a marvelously useful method of delegation and professional development. It's called the decision tree. The president of the company I worked for in my late 20s took me through this exercise when I was promoted to my first management role. She said, think of our company as a green and growing tree that bears fruit. In order to ensure its ongoing health, countless decisions are made daily, weekly, monthly. Right now, in your development, you have a good history of making decisions in certain areas, so let's think of these areas as leaf-level decisions. Make them, act on them, don't tell me what you did. Having said that, our goal is to move more decisions out to the leaf level. That's how you and I will both know you're developing as a leader. She drew a rough sketch of a tree and explained four categories of decisions. Leaf decisions, you make the decision, act on it, and do not report the action you took. Branch decisions, you make the decision, act on it, and report the action you took daily, weekly, or monthly. Trunk decisions, you make the decision, report your decision before you take action. Root decisions, these decisions are made jointly with input from many people. These are the decisions that, if poorly made and implemented, could cause major harm to the organization. The analogy of root, trunk, branch, and leaf decisions indicates the degree of potential harm or good to the organization as action is taken at each level. A trunk decision isn't necessarily more important than a leaf decision. Poor decisions at any level can hurt an organization. But if you unwittingly yank a leaf off a tree, the tree won't die. A leaf decision will not kill the tree if it is poorly made and executed. A wrong action at the root level, however, can cause tremendous damage. As an independent person who does not enjoy having someone looking over my shoulder, I thought I had died and gone to heaven when the decision tree clarified my professional development path. I knew I was progressing when I found myself making more and more decisions without the president's input. The goal of the decision tree is threefold. One, to identify clearly which categories decisions and actions fall into, so that an employee knows exactly where he or she has the authority to make decisions and take action. Two, to provide employees with a clear upward path of professional development. Progress is made when decisions are moved from root to trunk to branch to leaf categories. Third, to assist companies in consciously developing grassroots leadership within their organizations. This frees up executives to take on more challenging responsibilities themselves. A direct outcome of using the decision tree is that learning is provoked, one of the purposes of a fierce conversation. This is a great way to tell people where they are free to play and how they can grow. Best of all, if you follow the decision tree model, members of your team will take on more responsibilities, and your own to-do list will shrink. Give people information and a goal. Let them figure it out. The decision tree will help you do this. Additionally, the decision tree raises the level of personal accountability. Whenever we work diligently and possibly brilliantly to advise others concerning decisions in which they are involved, their internal reaction may be, "This is great. She's doing the work, coming up with all the ideas, and the bonus is I'm not putting myself or my own ideas at risk. I get to stay hidden." This conscious or unconscious internal response is incredibly expensive, both for the organization and for the individual. Trying to build leaders by regularly exposing them to your brilliance guarantees a lack of development. Engaging others in mineral rights conversations and providing a clear direction with a decision tree develops leaders by providing frequent opportunities for them to bring their own brilliance to the fore. For your assignment, put the decision tree to work as a delegation and leadership development tool for your team. If you have a teenager at home, use it with him or her as well. Explain the decision tree to your direct reports. Ask each of them to pay attention over the next 30 days to all of the decisions that fall within their responsibilities and to categorize them as leaf, branch, trunk, or root. Review their conclusions and reach consensus about where each kind of decision falls on the decision tree. Remind everyone that the goal is to move more and more decisions out to the leaf level. This is their leadership development path. Following this agreement, adhere to the boundaries and agreements required. For example, If someone comes to you for help in making a decision that falls within the trunk category, say, "Come back to me when you've made your decision, then we'll talk." In addition, during the coming week, focus on one conversation at a time. Just one at a time. And be there, in each of those conversations, prepared to be nowhere else. If you create the space, if you offer the invitation, what happens will be new and fresh. And if you are not attached to the result, it cannot be a disappointment. The rare and valuable gift you can give to others this week, and hopefully for many weeks and years to come, is to be fully present in the moment. When you are fully present in the moment, allowing each conversation to be brand new, you will be surprised. You will find more of the other person. You will find more of yourself. It's all a matter of choice.
Principle 4. Tackle your toughest challenge today.
Burnout happens not because we're trying to solve problems, but because we've been trying to solve the same problem over and over and over. Hand in hand with the courage to interrogate reality comes the courage to surface and confront your toughest, most often recurring, personal and professional issues. "Tell me again," I hear you ask, "exactly why I would put myself through this. Why would I subject myself and my organization to discomfort?" Because what's on the other side of your toughest issue is worth it. Relief, success, health, happiness, a high-performing team, a fulfilling personal relationship. And because of what's in store for you if you continue to avoid addressing and resolving the tough issues. Think confronting an executive about his or her behavior could be costly? Consider the cost of a good headhunter. Think confronting an emotional issue with a life partner is too risky? Ask your divorced friends how long it took for them to regain their sanity. Up to this point, you've worked hard to engage yourself and others in conversations that interrogate reality, provoke learning, and enrich relationships. Now you will learn skills needed to confront and resolve the issues that stand between you and success, between you and happiness. As an introduction to tackling tough challenges, let me tell you about my brother, Sam. In our teens, Sam and I had Saturday chores to attend to before we could do as we pleased. Sam's responsibility was to tackle the mole problem in our yard in Missouri. Each Saturday morning, Sam would look out the window and heave a sigh. Our yard was mole central. Dozens of trails ended in large mounds of freshly turned dirt. Resolute, Sam would head out the door to do battle. Sometimes he would use the hose, shoving it as far down into the burrows as possible. There would soon be rivulets of water running throughout the yard. Another approach was to stuff foul-smelling smoke bombs into the burrows, after which our yard resembled a fantastic galactic landscape riddled with active volcanoes spewing toxic fumes. And then there were the traps. In one battle plan, a mole would trigger the trap, whereupon it would be skewered. I didn't like to think about that one. Sam spent many Saturday mornings devoted to mole whacking. He took his job seriously. However, when the day came for him to move out on his own, Sam admitted that the only dead mole he ever saw had clearly died of old age. Many years later, Sam called me and said, "Suze, you won't believe it. I was at the hardware store standing in line behind a guy with a big bag of something that had a skull and crossbones on it. I asked him what it was for, and he said, 'The mole problem.' So I asked him, 'How do you get that stuff down into the burrows?' And he said, 'Oh, it's not for the moles. You sprinkle it on the grass, and it kills the grubs that the moles eat.'" There was a moment of silence on the line, and then I overheard a faint, "Damn." As I chuckled, Sam continued, "If I'd gone after the grubs, I could have spent Saturday mornings riding my bicycle. The thing is, I'm still whacking moles. It's what I do all day at work. And I'm good at it. An enthusiastic and capable mole whacker." Almost every morning I wake up weighed down with the items on my to-do list, so I get up and come to work early, determined to make progress, to get that one thing that's nagging me handled, only to find someone leaning in the doorway of my office, holding a mole, saying, "We've got a problem, boss." "Okay," I say, "put that problem on my desk and let me take a whack at it." Half an hour or an hour later, when that person drags the mole out of my office, just when I think, now I'll focus on my top priority, the phone rings, and it's somebody else, who essentially says, "Boss, I got a mole here I need to run by you." By 4 in the afternoon, when the last sorry mole has been carted out of my office, I'm running on fumes. "I couldn't have an original thought if my life depended on it," Sam concluded, "and I still haven't tackled item number 1 on my own to-do list. This is the stuff of my days, and this, I recognize, is a problem." Sound familiar? Behind one mole is another one. For many of us, mole whacking seems to be the stuff of our professional lives. And let's face it, in a way, mole whacking is kind of fun. It's satisfying when people turn to you to whack moles for them. After all, you've gotten this far in your career because you're known for your mole-whacking skills. Besides, if you are no longer a mole-whacker, who would you be? What would you do? So we continue mole-whacking, and by mid-afternoon we are exhausted, having expended precious energy flailing around on the periphery, in the margins, rather than identifying and tackling core issues, the grubs that attract the moles. Leaders devoted to mole-whacking are frozen in place professionally, as are the people who report to them. Make it your job as a leader to give up mole-whacking and take up grub-hunting. Implementing the decision tree will help you accomplish this important transition. Whenever a member of a team has an issue on which he or she would like input, preparing an issue presentation before the meeting helps to prevent incoherent or incomplete explanations of the problem. The issue presentation is a discussion form that includes a concise presentation of what the issue is, its significance, your ideal outcome, relevant background information, what you have done up to this point, and finally, the help you want from the group. The team appreciates good use of their time. At the top of the appreciation list is the accurate identification of the problem. Since the problem named is the problem solved, it is crucial to spend time in the problem naming part of the exercise. If that takes a while, it takes a while. Unfortunately, after half an hour or so of sincerely attempting to help someone who has misnamed the issue, most people find it difficult to muster the energy and attention needed to shift gears and stay engaged. What is the recurring problem in the organization? How does the system reward this? Where does the problem originate? What is the grub? I know from experience that high-performing teams get frustrated when they feel they are doing the pre-work a colleague should have done beforehand. They like it short and simple. They like to hit the ground running. This preparation form helps team members grasp the issue and its importance and quickly provides the group with the relevant information and context needed for good work. Once the issue is on the table, what is the role of the team? Unfortunately, what most people do the minute someone says, "I have a problem," is to say, "I have a solution." We dive into answers before our companion has finished describing the issue. Preventing this behavior is one of the reasons for the secret rule I mentioned earlier. Yes, each of us may have a solution, could be a darn good one. Yet our solution is only one solution. If our job is to make the best possible decisions for the company, or the team, or the family, or to help others do this, we need access to all available options. Often I've witnessed someone bring an issue to the team and say, "I am considering options A, B, and C. Which one do you think is best?" Only to discover that there is an option Q out there that he or she didn't even know existed. An option Q is exquisite and complete. By jumping in too quickly, team members often offer solutions to a mole-level problem, missing the grub altogether. No matter how much work someone has done to correctly name the problem, that person may not have hit the nail on the head. Before jumping in with solutions, it is essential to spend some time asking clarifying questions. When a facilitator leads this kind of conversation, his or her most important role is to create spaciousness throughout the conversation, which helps individuals and teams discover what the conversation really wants and needs to be about. If you are leading the discussion, encourage your peers to ask questions for quite a while. And remember, no cheating with leading questions. Your ideas may be wonderful and absolutely appropriate, but don't be too quick to interject them. Once the team members are satisfied that the real issue has been identified and they have all of the relevant information, move to ideas for solutions. Let this be relatively free-flowing. Make sure you call on anyone who hasn't spoken. Ask, "What's your take on this?" Begin wrapping up the discussion by asking everyone to formulate a one-sentence recommendation. You can say, "Okay, no more discussion. I'd like each of you to distill your thoughts into a one-sentence recommendation. I'll give you a minute to write it down. The question is, if you were Joe, what would you do?" After 1 minute, go around the table and have each team member give his or her recommendation. The person with the issue may not respond, only listen. When people know they will always be asked to provide focused advice, to put a personal stake into the ground, no one tunes out. Just as important is that everyone's voice is heard. Thus, everyone has an equal place at the table. You can then ask the member with the issue, "What did you hear?" When the issue presenter knows this is coming, he or she will pay fierce attention to everything said during the meeting, particularly to everyone's final recommendation. Close the discussion by asking the member with the issue, "What actions are you committed to taking and when will you take them?" This is a satisfying end to an issue discussion. Nothing is left in the air, unclear. Everyone knows what's going to happen next around this issue. Occasionally, someone may respond, "I need time to digest these ideas. I will let you know what action I'll take by next Monday." Be sure then to follow up. Make sure that the member with the issue lets the team know what has been done so far, the results, and the intended next steps. When a team has worked hard to help a peer, it deserves to know what happened next. If the issue to be explored is complex and the thoughts likely to be complicated, consider taping the issue discussion. Following the meeting, give the tape to the person who brought the issue to the table. That way, the individual won't feel he or she must take notes during the discussion. Knowing that everything is captured on tape allows the issue presenter to be fully present, maintain eye contact, and really listen throughout the discussion. Many times I've heard people say, "When I listened to the tape, I heard some useful thoughts and ideas that I missed in the meeting." Some things are much more difficult to talk about than others. Many business groups and family members operate with an unspoken rule book, including a list of undiscussables, topics that are too risky to bring up. After all, your last attempt netted you 2 weeks as the corporate pariah, or you ended up sleeping on the couch. Some topics on the undiscussables list are in the form of quid pro quo agreements. Without discussing it, everyone instinctively understands the deal that has been struck. I won't mention your bungling of the Ross account if you won't bring up how many people have left my team. Or, I won't mention your drinking if you don't talk about my weight. Sometimes we avoid saying what needs to be said because we're sure there will be consequences. We think, Are you crazy? Say that to him and he'll hand you your head on a platter. Or, I think my husband is having an affair, but if I confront him with the evidence, he'll deny it, tell me I'm the one with the problem, and refuse to touch me for a month. Are you dodging a challenge? In my work with leaders and their teams, I've discovered that a universal talent is the ability to avoid difficult conversations. I take the high road is often an excuse for not tackling the issue. It is far better to take the direct road. Granted, revealing painful truths, our own and others, is tough. But if you really want to resolve the issue, go directly to the source and confront the person's behavior one-to-one in private. Understandably, many of us fear confrontation because it hasn't gone well in the past. All attempts to date have failed miserably. We don't know how to make it better this time, and the stakes are fairly high. Our fears may include a confrontation could escalate the problem rather than resolve it. I could be rejected. I could lose the relationship. Confronting the behavior could force an outcome for which I am not prepared. Yet, the very outcomes we fear in confronting someone's behavior are practically guaranteed to show up if we don't. It will just take longer and will likely occur at the worst possible moment when we are least expecting it, with a huge price tag attached. When people first hear the term fierce conversation, they often assume it's a conversation in which you tell someone exactly what you think of them and the horse they rode in on. If this was your first impression, I hope that by now you've gained a different perspective. Even so, when it comes to the topic of confrontation, many people picture angry faces, clenched teeth, roiling emotions, because of their negative context around confrontation. For example, let's imagine you believe that dogs are dangerous. The door opens and a dog walks in and heads towards you. You're afraid. The dog didn't scare you. Your belief scared you. When you believe projects like this are stressful, or my spouse always gets angry, these beliefs determine how you feel and therefore what you do. I'd like to recast the whole notion of confrontation. The meaning of the Spanish word con is with. Therefore, the word confront could mean to be with someone in front of something. Conversation and confrontation both begin with the idea of with. The fierce version of confrontation is not firing at someone from across the room, but rather standing side by side looking at the issue together. All confrontation is a search for the truth. Who owns the truth? Each of us owns a piece of it, and nobody owns all of it. Let's keep in mind that a confrontation is a conversation. Like all fierce conversations, the four purposes of a confrontation are to interrogate reality, provoke learning, tackle tough challenges, and enrich relationships. Think about these four purposes. When we are preparing to confront someone's behavior, our obligation is to describe our reality concerning the behavior, and then invite our partner to describe reality from his or her point of view. When multiple realities are explored, learning is provoked, and most people are willing to take action once they've gained a new understanding. Such conversations enrich relationships. Here's your assignment. Think of that conversation out there with your name on it, the conversation that every subatomic particle in your body would prefer to avoid. Write down the person you want to have the conversation with and the topic. For example, your boss. Our company lacks a clear, compelling vision. A customer. Working with you is unpleasant and difficult. We may need to part company. Your spouse. I love you, but I do not love our life together. A friend. I'm concerned that you may have a drinking problem. Before I talk you through a model for successfully having this conversation and coming away from it with all your body parts intact, consider the case of Sam, who had a problem to solve. This is not my brother, but a different Sam, the CEO of a software company. Sam is a thoughtful leader and a truly good human being who was beaming when I walked into his office for our monthly one-to-one. He reported that he had successfully recruited Jackie, known in the software industry as a miracle worker with a reputation for never missing a deadline.